From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
If you listen and learn, then you're going to be able to do anything you want in this town.
Everybody thinks show business is really, really all white lights, peaches and cream.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone Hollywood.
This week on The Business, we meet a couple of top animal trainers and some of their furry or feathered stars, plus an aspiring comedian's ambivalence about her day job. But first, it's the Hollywood News Banter. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW.
You can imagine Hollywood, everything is really driven by
making money.
What's with him?
I am joined by my banter buddy, John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. Hello, John.
Hello, Kim. Welcome back.
Thank you. It was a lovely break, but here I am. You know, John, we've talked a lot in the earlier part of this year about how terrible the box office was and how all these big movies were tanking, but there's been quite a resurgence of some hit movies lately. Notably at the moment, Sony seems to have pulled off a successful reboot of Spider-Man, which was a huge franchise, huge, really gave the studio its life for the last several years, and now they've completely rebooted it, and it's going very well.
And among reboots, one of the fastest reboots in Hollywood history, but clearly incredibly successful. This is a movie that's on track to make hundreds of millions of dollars, so we will have a sequel to the reboot very soon, I am sure.
Meanwhile, Ted is doing great for Universal, the R-rated comedy, but one of the more interesting stories, too, is this movie Magic Mike, which stars Channing Tatum as a male stripper. It's attracting a lot of the girls and some of the boys and doing very well for a movie with a little budget that I think was covered in part by Channing Tatum and Steven Soderbergh.
Yeah, I heard a conversation in the parking lot of my church over the weekend where the youth minister said to another girlfriend, "Don't you want to come with us and see Channing Tatum strip?" So when the youth minister at a church is talking about going to see a stripper movie, you know that there's overall support for Channing Tatum. Now, he was a stripper in real life before he became an actor, and I guess I use the word actor loosely. This is a guy who's never going to win any Academy Awards, but he is what he is. And the amazing thing about Tatum is he stars in movies that don't cost a ton of money. I mean, Magic Mike was about $8 million, 21 Jump Street, I think mid-40s. The Vow, which was a Screen Gems movie, was about $30 million. These movies are not super expensive. They don't necessarily travel well overseas, but they do a ton of business domestically, certainly relative to their cost.
And, you know, Hollywood has been really hungry for a movie star, another movie star. Movie stars are kind of in short supply. And Channing Tatum has shown somehow, I don't know who's the architect, he with his agents or whatever, they've been very shrewd and built him into being what is a guy who can now do, as you point out, comedy, romance. He's turning into a movie star.
And next spring, he's in a sequel to a movie that probably at best broke even, which is G.I. Joe. Now, that's a much more expensive action movie. But about a year ago when Paramount started talking about doing a sequel to G.I. Joe, there's a lot of head scratching because the first movie was not a success. And I think their timing now looks incredibly smart. And I suspect that
next year. I got to stop you there. I mean, that was a movie that got pushed out of 2012 into 2013, reportedly because of all kinds of troubles. I think they killed his character off and are trying to bring it back to life. So I don't know if we want to give them credit for being smart with Channing Tatum specifically or lucky, but maybe it will help them with what is, as you point out, a really expensive movie.
Well, better to be lucky than good, right?
Absolutely. Meanwhile, in the movie star world, as you undoubtedly know, John, I know you know that Tom Cruise and Katie Holmes are Splitsville, and we're not going to talk tabloid on that, but we will talk business. Tom Cruise reconstructed his career after getting into a bit of a bog when he became, let's say, overly enthusiastic about expressing his support for Scientology. And people didn't react well to that. He dug himself out of that and really got out of what we would call movie star jail. I think, you know, Mission Impossible 4 was supposed to be a handoff, and he was supposed to be sort of ushered out while they handed the franchise to Jeremy Renner, and he came back just with guns blazing on the screen and off and made it into a huge hit and reestablished himself as a movie star. He's got a diverse number of interesting, different kinds of movies going. And this has dragged him again into this whole issue of Scientology.
No, when you say he got into a bit of a bog, I mean, I think that's a little bit of an understatement. I mean, I think audiences want to see movie stars be movie stars. And Tom Cruise became famous for going after Brooke Shields about her postpartum depression, talking about psychiatry, getting in an argument with Matt Lauer on the Today Show. In other words, his personal and religious views took precedence over his acting and his movies. And he worked very hard to kind of rehabilitate his career. And I think the potential for the producers of his next movies, the potential for concern is that the divorce, questions about Scientology, which have been tabloid fodder of the last week, are going to eclipse the movies themselves. And that is toxic at the box office.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, Kim.
That's John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. A couple of months ago, the business producer, Darby Maloney, and I took a road trip about 2 hours northeast of Los Angeles to dusty Acton, California. As we hit the bumpy dirt road leading to our destination, the setting didn't seem very Hollywood, but we were there to meet some of the biggest stars of recent films. We had arrived at the West Coast offices of Birds and Animals Unlimited, a talent agency that's been in the business for 40 years. There we met Mathilde Decagny, a top animal trainer who worked with Moose, the four-legged star of Frasier, and dogs who performed in last year's Hugo and Beginners. We were greeted very enthusiastically by an energetic yellow lab who had the title role in a film that also starred Owen Wilson and Jennifer Aniston.
The dog that you see back there, which I might go get and pull out for you, this is Clyde. He did Marley and Me.
Bad dog, Marley! Marley! Stop it! Marley! Let go! Let go! Marley! Marley!
This is the real Marley. Clyde! Good.
Clyde looks happy to see you.
Yes. Yeah, it was interesting, the training about the Mali dogs, because I actually had to train him to act all crazy like that. And I had gone and gotten some couches and leather chairs and clothing and all kinds of stuff. So you will be taught to actually destroy and trash everything he could.
I mean, I know a lot of people have trouble training their dogs not to chew up their furniture, but how do you train a dog to chew up furniture?
Well, but pretty much everything I do training-wise has a lot to do with toys. And so for Clyde, I would hide some of his tennis ball or one of his favorite toys into a spot. You start with a pillow, for instance, so it's kind of easy. You hold on the pillow, show him the toy, and kind of let him get it a couple times, and then you kind of sew it back up and close it and give him a chance for him to tear it up. They get it really fast. They understand the concept and the game. And I did very little rehearsals with the actors because we wanted to have this natural feel and them to be surprised, and they never knew. I knew what he was going to do because it has to be very controlled and you kind of need to know what's going to happen. But we saved it as surprises for the actors. But I will get on set and I will say the cue word was like, go get it, Clyde. And then they knew it was going to be trouble. And it could be like him jumping on Owen Wilson or him grabbing a pillow. But the go get it, Clyde, like everybody will like scatter away.
Does he work beyond Marley?
He does. He actually, I've used him on Marmaduke, and he's got a great asset, which is a dog that just never gets tired.
And I can see that.
I can work him, and really for our business, it's something you really use all the time. Good, you're a good boy. Stay. So let me reassure you, he didn't do the dying scene.
I was going to say, is he going to do a dying scene for us now?
This is a... No, back.
Who did the dying? How is that
back
done?
Up, back. We actually used an old dog. Sit. Good, stay. He was a private owned dog that was 13 and that they let us use for a couple scenes. And everybody was crying when we did that scene, even though we were shooting and the dog was just all good and well alive. But we couldn't take it. No one could take it. The director, everybody was crying. It was just one of the toughest scenes I've done.
Remember how we were always saying what a pain you are? You're the world's worst dog. Don't believe it. Don't believe it even for a minute. Because you know we couldn't find a better dog.
Who is this? This is
Cosmo. Hello, Cosmo. Arthur in the Beginners movie. Cosmo is a rescue. He's a Jack Russell Terrier. I got him. He was at least 5 or 6 years old. And he's one of those that just like loves to work. And Cosmo is a really awesome little actor dog. And I tell you why, because he's very natural. And his relationship with Ewan was absolutely spectacular and pretty unique in a way that they fell in love with each other so much. They spent all their time together. Ewan was completely taken by the dog and the training, and I wanted to participate and be part of everything. And that made this movie feel so flawless in their relationship.
Arthur, you're coming to live with me now, okay? This is my car.
Didn't he want to take him home?
He did. And as a matter of fact, he came up to me and he said, you know, can I have Cosmo at the end of the show? And I said, not even in your dream. And so we went and searched for a rescue dog for him to take. Nevertheless, it was just a day after we'd done shooting, he had adopted his little dog, Sid, that goes with him everywhere.
If you're just joining us, I'm Kim Masters and this is The Business. We're out in the field on a dusty ranch with animal trainer Mathilde DeCagny. We also met her colleague, David Sousa, whose expertise is birds. His credits include The Matrix Reloaded, and he trained the owls on all the Harry Potter films. Now, who is this?
This is Crash. And Crash is a 5-year-old Eurasian eagle owl. And it's the same type of owls that we used on Harry Potter. Not the same owl, but the same type. All those birds that we use on the film are still over there. Are still in England.
He's a big bird. You've got nerves of steel.
Oh no, it's just being comfortable around him, knowing which direction they're going to go in. You know, I could feel every body when she moves her body, what she's thinking, just by where her feet are.
Did you have to get, you know, Daniel Radcliffe to interact with the owl?
You got to remember when we started with these films, the kids were only, you know, 9 and 10 years old, and the owls weighed about 4.5 pounds. So when we first started filming him, Dan, he'd have to wear a brace to hold the owl up. He did that for about 1.5 weeks until he got his arm strong enough. He'd actually come down and sit with us in trailers and just sit with the owls and get comfortable with the owls, get the movement of the owls. And the very first time you see Dan walking out with the owls in the cloisters at the Hogwarts when he releases the owl. And we're all standing right by there just in case the owl decided to go early, you know, or he got really tired because he was walking out with it, you know. But then after a while, I mean, it just became second nature to Dan, you know.
Now, are the animals, do they have agents?
They do. The agent is actually the company we're working for.
And so the trainer works with the agency for the animals.
Exactly, yes. The production's office will be calling, you know, our management, and they are in charge of all the schedules and budget and all that stuff.
So they just come to you, you're not out there saying, get my dog.
No, pretty much they do. They call us, they call the company and send us a script. Either we have some animals that we can show already, and it's kind of like the actors. There's an audition being made, and we bring them. Or we will say, look, you know, we will go and get the animals and train them from scratch.
But I mean, when you say an audition, do you show up with your dog and then the next guy's coming with a different dog from a different training company?
Correct. Yes. Yeah.
Is there like a rivalry and you sort of go, hello?
I don't think so.
We know each other. We know pretty much all. And it's one of those, you know, you get it or not.
You guys have the Humane Society on set with you?
We have a human society. It's not required by the trainers. It's up to the production to get a stamp and approval. And the human society is out there to monitor the welfare of the animals, of course. But also, if we have a production that will be pushy, that will ask of the trainer to do something we don't want to do, then it protects us to say, no, we're not okay with it.
They're a real nice buffer for us between the production. We can say something to them, like Matilda said, and they can go to the director. Or a lot of times they come up to us and say, hey, we're not comfortable with this. You know, how do you feel? Have you trained this before? Have you got this down? Can I see what you have?
And what about, do you get harassed at all? I mean, I know PETA had been writing, in the case of Lux, saying you're not taking care of the horses. Do you guys find that they're a thorn in your side, or I assume they don't want animals working, period.
They do not want animals working, period. And I think there is a little unfairness to this, because they don't look at what we actually really do for the animals. And animals are being rescued, trained, getting a second chance, a life that they would have never gotten otherwise. Most of those animals, you know, have not such a good life to begin with, especially in the case of dogs, which I usually, when I go to a rescue or shelter, I will say, give me the one that nobody wants. And in the case of Moose, the dog on Fraser, for instance, he was a dog that had several homes and been rejected and was just a troublemaker, and nobody wanted to do anything with him. And he was a character. He was a really difficult dog. And if it wasn't for him to be in the hand of a trainer, he wouldn't have gotten a chance. No one had the patience or knew how to deal with that kind of animals, even.
We look for that type of personality, you know. The things that she said it perfectly, the things that nobody wants. Mm-hmm. If, you know, I got told today, my friend called me up and said, I got a goose I need to get rid of. It's really aggressive. Well, that's the type of goose I want, because that's the goose that's going to learn how to pull somebody's pant leg and pull something across the yard and, you know.
Exactly. I mean, we utilize everything we see in an animal. And so all those wacky things that comes up, and one of my Jack Russells, the backup of Cosmo, he snarls a lot. So that will scare everybody. Nobody's going to go pick up a dog from a shelter that's like snarling all the time, and he's always like, arr. Well, it turns out that there's not really a mean bone. He's doing it, and yeah, it's a little
intimidating
is the word, absolutely. But me, I loved it. I was just like, oh, you know how hard it is to train a dog to teach us. So now he does it on cue perfectly at all time. I mean, all I have to do is, you know, snarl, and he just goes, argh. The only thing that we can't work with is an animal that has fear, too much fear. So you want those ones that are actually overconfident.
Do you ever feel like they know they're acting?
In case of dogs, for sure, they do know. What they know is action, and they do know when you rehearse and when you actually shoot. It's amazing. They pick on it pretty fast.
I mean, do you feel like some of them are hams?
Absolutely, yes. The dogs on Fraser, I mean, the Moose, we will rehearse all week and get ready. And then he knew on Tuesday the band will go on, which means it was shoot nights. Mm-hmm. And that dog will change his attitude in a heartbeat.
Oh, because you're shooting in front of a live audience,
yes,
on Fraser.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So all of a sudden he's all like, I'm Moose, you can see me later if you want to and come to my trailer.
Later, it was more like, look what I can do syndrome.
Coming up after a short break, more with the animal trainers, plus an aspiring comedian who toils at a lowly job that she just can't quit. To make a comment about today's show, go to kcrw.com/thebusiness. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
You're listening to The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking with two of Hollywood's top animal trainers, Mathilde Decagni and David Sousa. In recent years, as tax credits have lured productions out of California, these trainers, like other crew members, must often work far from home. You're wearing a wedding ring.
Yeah, I just recently got married a year ago. So, yeah, I've got my first child coming on the 31st of August.
How's that going to work out, though?
My wife doesn't work. Right. Yeah, so she's going to travel with me. We just did the first thing, traveling together and being together up in Fernie, B.C. for Santa Pups. It's a little doggy puppy movie that we did up there. It was great. I was married before to an animal trainer in the business, and her going one way, me going the other way, it lasted for about 14 years, and then it fizzled.
I mean, I don't know, Mathilde, you have a son, too. I don't know.
Yeah, that's
I have a son. He's traveled with me everywhere up until he started first grade, but otherwise he was in Ireland. We did Lassie. We was in Miami, did Marley and Me, everywhere, New York. And nowadays, he's in second grade. I pick and choose a little bit more of the movies, where it's going to be and when. So it's a lifestyle. You know, this job is a passion. And you can't think of every little thing. You just follow your heart and your passion, and you have an animal, you have a script, and you want to go make this movie. And I think, you know, your life follows with it. And it's the same for my son. I mean, he's grown up around an orangutan. He was raised with a baby orangutan. He was had amazing experiences. He's around alligators. He's around everything.
He's the coolest kid in show and tell, I bet.
Yeah, no doubt.
Those were animal trainers Mathilde Decagni and David Sousa. Well, Mathilde and David love their jobs. Many people struggling to make it in the business aren't so lucky. They have to take day jobs to pay the bills while they chase their dreams. And sometimes, maybe even most of the time, those day jobs turn into unloved careers. Sharon Houston came to Hollywood to make it in comedy. She's done stand-up on Showtime and Comedy Central, but those gigs aren't paying the bills, at least not yet. This comes to us from KCRW's storytelling podcast, Strangers.
When you come to Hollywood to be an actor or a comedian or a writer, you expect that you're going to be exploited in some way, used. But you think if you take enough of these crappy gigs, it's going to pay off and you're going to get the dream job. And that's why I came here. But I found myself on the side of the people who exploit other people. I work in daytime court TV. People think I'm paid to find strong cases for the courtroom. Not true. I am paid to exploit racial stereotypes. If I book someone who's black, they have to be really black. If you book someone who's gay, they have to be flaming. You know, we like them when they're in drag. We book baby mamas, baby daddies, hoarders, cutters, people with fetishes. And the freakier, the better, and my job is to book them. We had a competition in the office. You know, we were like, oh, who can book a little person? So I was going to the Little Persons Association and trying to contact people. I would Google news stories about little people and see if anybody was suing someone. And it never happened. Cut to a few years later, as I'm calling on claims and calling on claims, I get this person who is a little person. He is an exotic dancer. He has a foot fetish. And his name is Corn Pop. I was running through the office. I told my EP, I'm like, check it out. Guess what his name is? Corn Pop. And then, you know, that's a case that's going to go to sweeps. You know, that's a case that's going to air when we're looking for ad dollars. And when you book a sweeps case, it's a big deal. You know, your boss is happy for you. The studio's happy for you. Everyone's, you know, saying good job, you know. And I like to do a good job no matter where I am. I like people to like me. It's why I'm a comedian. So there is, like, sometimes I get a thrill out of finding these, like, unique people that you didn't think existed, but other times it's a soul crusher. When I'm talking to them, I don't really care about what they're suing for. I just want to know if they're colorful and passionate and are going to say lots of horrible things about each other. And once I get to that point, then I have to ask them for a picture because I want to see what they look like. And then I have to ask them if they have teeth. And that's very humiliating because they're like, well, why would you ask me that? And I'm like, well, we have to know. And they say, well, of course I have teeth. And I go, okay, well, send me a picture of just your teeth. What happens is they say they have teeth, and then I say, well, I need a picture. Then they call me right before they send the picture and go, I forgot to tell you, I'm missing a front tooth. And I go, no problem, because we will get you some teeth. Just send me the picture. I get the picture. And I get them actual dental work. It's kind of a cheapy job. Like early in the process, the teeth just become kind of gray. And the only way that we can correct that is by painting them. And there's this stuff that you can get at a makeup supply store. And it kind of looks like liquid paper in person. But when it's on camera, it looks like they have sparkling white teeth. I mean, the majority of the people we book on these shows, they're very poor. They can't afford a snack at the airport. And the simplest things that we all do, which is just basically self-care, they can't do because they just don't have the money. And it's a bummer. They usually try to steal the clothing after. We have to stand outside the dressing room and go, okay, I just want to make sure, before you leave, I have to count and make sure the shoes are here, is the belt here, are the pants here, is the shirt here, did you return the wig, can we have the earrings back? Okay, great, now we can send you back to the airport. But for some reason, I think it's denial. They feel like something could change in their lives any day that would make their lives better. They have this, like, false hope. But I'm sitting here saying, you guys are in denial. I'm trying to make it in Hollywood. Who's in denial here? You know, I mean, I have this job because it keeps a roof over my head and I need new headshots and I still have to pay for parking when I do spots at the store or the improv. And especially living in an expensive city like L.A., I have nothing. I have nothing. But they think I am famous. They think I'm a rock star. They think I own a home. I'm like, no, I'm nothing. I mean, there's a hierarchy. It goes feature films, one-hour dramas, half-hour comedies, late-night talk shows, music videos, commercials, daytime talk shows, reality TV, porn, snuff films, Jersey Shore, daytime court TV. So we're at the bottom. I didn't talk about working in court until like 3 years ago, and I've been doing it for 10. People ask me what I did, and I would rather say I attempt because it was embarrassing. And then I'd run into friends on lots, and they'd go, oh, my God, what are you doing here? And they're writing on a TV show or they're starring on a TV show. And I usually don't tell them why I'm there, or I just say, listen, I got to tell you something. I work in court. They're like, oh, no, I'm so sorry. And I'm like, yeah, it's all right. And then they say, well, you know, call me if you need anything. Are you going to be all right? The cases I really hate are the DNA cases. Court shows love DNA cases, so we do them a lot. A lot of the times on these DNA cases, the kids are old enough to know, oh, something's up. This guy who I've been calling dad might not be my dad. And I think they should have the right to be told by their parents and not a TV show. And these cases are particularly hard for me because I found out that my dad wasn't my dad when I was 9 years old. It's a really difficult thing for a young kid to go through. And to have that exploited on TV, I hate it. So sometimes the job gets really brutal and tough, and you listen to the sad stories all day, and I just can't take it anymore, and I reach a breaking point. My breaking point is taking half a Vicodin with 2 ibuprofen to take the edge off, and then I'll take a little nap under my desk for about 20 minutes, and then I pop back up, ready to roll. At the end of every season, I always go, I'm not going back. I don't want to go back. I'm never working in this genre again. And then a few months go by, and then I end up getting sucked right back in. Everyone who works in court always ends up going back. I always say it's like prison, and you just become a repeat offender. Like, you get out, you do your time, you get out, you're like, I'm free. I'm never doing that again, because that was a mistake. Then you screw up, or things aren't staffing, or you just miss it, and you're like, I got to go back. I really miss prison food. You know, you just always end up going back. Always. And you're like, please, someone save me.
Sharon Houston is a comedian and a producer in daytime court TV. An extended version of this story can be heard on KCRW's storytelling podcast, Strangers, which you can find at kcrw.com/strangers. And that's The Business. Darby Maloney produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Special thanks today to Leah Tao. The show is produced and distributed by KCRW. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.